Hello, everybody, and welcome to Elmtown episode 20. We've got another spotlight today. This morning it's going to be, this morning for me, it's evening for Aussie, who we're going to talk to. We're going to have a spotlight on Aussie Hanhinen, which I think I said right, or Aussie Hanhinen. My accent is not excellent, but hey, Aussie, do you want to say hello?
Hello.
Excellent, and we're going to hear a lot more from Aussie in just a minute, including asking if I said his name right. So I'm going to preemptively apologize before we start this episode, just in case I say embarrassing things, because I'm American and North American and was born North American, and I've only been to Europe a number of times. And so if I say embarrassing things like I don't know where country X is or things like that, I really apologize and ask your forgiveness. So hopefully everyone will be nice to me, and let's get started. Okay, so announcements. We got some announcements before the sponsors this time. The remote meetup is coming back. It'll take place on Thursday, the 28th of September at 6 o'clock p.m. UTC. So that's 1800 hours UTC, 12 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Join the remote meetup channel on Slack, on the Elm Slack, for more information. That's hashtag remote-meetup. So if you want to join in and be part of the worldwide Elm meetup, then go right there and add your valuable opinion to the mix. Now on to our lovely sponsors. First up, we've got Day One, which is the company that I work for. It's a beautiful life archiving and journaling app for Mac, iOS, coming soon to other platforms. I love journaling. I think it has a great effect on the life of the person who's journaling, and I like to do it in an organized way and a beautiful way, and that's why I came to Day One, is because I loved the app already, and I came and I wanted to work on it. And plus, I got to use Elm here. I got to introduce Elm, and I've loved that, and we're happy with it, and hopefully you'll be happy too if you check out our product. Next is Daily Drip, a training service that makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. Daily Drip provides small but powerful lessons to level you up in a number of topics, including Elm, Elixir, CSS, and HTML. After signing up for Daily Drip, every weekday you'll get a short video, about 5 minutes, or a reading delivered to your inbox. And if you sign up using the coupon code ELMTOWN, all lowercase, all one word, ELMTOWN-2017, the year that this episode is recorded, ELMTOWN-2017, you'll save $9 on your first month, and you'll show support for the show. Because if they get a ton of people signing up with that coupon code, they'll know that they want to sponsor us again. And last but not least is Futurist, who Aussie currently belongs to as an employee. And Futurist is a new breed of an innovation consultancy with digital values at its core. They believe in happy people, happy customers, and happy users. They are users of Elm, community contributors, and innovators in the open source space. They hire good people, and they do good work. And one of those good people is with us here today. I want to send a big thank you out to the listeners like you who are supporting the podcast. One, a listener like you has charitably and generously donated the funds necessary to provide hosting for the podcast. So thank you very much. And this episode is produced by Fergus Meeklejohn. So big thanks to Fergus too. Now, Aussie, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit before we get started on you, because this is going to be a spotlight episode. So it's going to be all about you, all about where you came from, all about what you do. But I do want to know a little bit about Futurist, because I always introduce them at the beginning. How do you feel about working at Futurist? What do you love about it? And yeah, tell us a little bit about Futurist, if you don't mind.
Futurist is a nice company. It's essentially a consultancy, but the way we do work is somewhat different from the other consultancies in Finland, in that we want to place an entire team at the customer's office and then work with the customer the whole time, which gives like an intense like belonging
in
the customer's project.
It's like a whole team for rent almost.
Yeah. And we always like try to pick up people who already know each other and are known to work together well. So it's a great place to be.
That's awesome. So how many employees are there?
So in total, we have like 450, I think.
Woo.
And in the Helsinki office where I work, there's about 200, a bit more maybe.
Wow. So do you go into the Helsinki office every day, or are you on location with the clients at their offices?
Mostly I go to the customer office when I'm in a project. And on Fridays, we always have a common day at the home office or at the Futurist office.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And there are, I understand it, multiple locations throughout Europe. Is that right?
Right. So we have two offices in Finland, but then also two offices in Germany, so Berlin and Munich, and then one office in London and one in Stockholm. So, yeah.
That's a lot of offices. And so it sounds like basically you could live almost anywhere in Europe and find an interesting job with Futurist. Are you hiring right now?
Yeah, we are always hiring.
What kinds of skills are you looking for? What kinds of skill sets?
Well, it's difficult to say because basically the projects are not there before you get hired. So you're not hired to do a specific job, but instead you just get hired to Futurist and then you end up in a project that mostly is what you do anyway, but
yeah,
you will always like learn something new as well.
So let's say you've got a background in Element Elixir because you've been doing that on the side. Would that be the kind of thing you'd be interested in someone doing or coming with that experience?
Sure, yeah. We just actually got a new employee that had done some hobby projects with Elixir and Elm. So yeah, that's definitely something we're looking for.
Do you find yourself working with like Rails most often in your client projects? Or I'm sure the clients have stipulations about what they want. Is that the case?
I would say the most common backend is Play, with like Scala Play.
Okay.
And the most common frontend probably is React with Redux.
Okay, yeah.
But it really tends to vary with the team. So
have there been any projects that have actually used Elm on the front end in production?
Yeah. There's like at least 4 projects that are using Elm in production, yeah.
Awesome. Oh, that's way cool. Are you on one of those projects or are those other team members?
I've been in 2 of those.
One of those is not a native project, right? I think that was Thoughtbot that published that they had used Elm Native to make a mobile app. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. So Elm Native UI is entirely a hobby thing.
And that came from you originally, correct?
Right. Me and Andre Stoltz originally created that.
I didn't know that Andre. I thought that Andre was mostly spending all of his time on Cycle. But does he do Elm stuff too?
I would say he doesn't do Elm, but he was like my React Native mentor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, of ourselves. So let's start back at the beginning. Were you born in Finland?
I was, yes.
Very cool. Same part where you live now or different part of the city?
Yeah, like 10 kilometers away.
Very cool.
That translates to, I guess, 6 miles.
There you go. Thanks for translating it to North American. So the funny thing is we should all be using kilometers because it's just a way better system, but some of us are stuck with an inferior measurement system here.
Right.
Unfortunately. So close to home. Have you been there most of your life? Have you left and gone around? What's been your experience traveling, living?
So I've lived in essentially 2 cities, and the other one was near the border of Lapland in Finland.
Oh, okay. And at what point do you find an interest in computers in your life?
I was born in 87.
Okay.
And my dad was actually in IT at the time.
Okay.
So
working for a local like enterprise company, I'm assuming?
Yes, a very enterprise company. It still exists in Finland and it's very large. And he had PC at home. I think it was like 386 or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
And we had DOS on it, and my older sister, who's 5 years older than me, she used to play some games on it. I remember at least the IBM Alley Cat game.
Nice.
Which she would play and I would watch. And that was like my first contact with computers. I was probably 3 or 4 years old at the time.
We had a similar thing at home, too. We used to load in Captain Keen on floppy disks, and I didn't know how to use the DOS prompt to get it started, so I had to wait for my older brother to do it. But yeah, similar thing, I think.
Yeah.
So that was your first contact with computers, and then, I mean, you watched her play the games. At what point did you actually start to control computers yourself?
Sure. So at some point, I would like learn the commands by heart. I would not actually understand what I'm doing because, well, it was all in English, you know?
So that's interesting. So your dad then had to have enough of a command of English to be able to do the IT stuff well, is that right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And did he, or was he a fluent English speaker, or did he just learn it for work?
I think he learned it at school.
Okay. And was that something that was spoken at home at all, or was it all, okay, here's one of those moments I was apologizing for, and just making sure Finnish is the native language of Finland,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And we only speak Finnish at home. So English we only learn for communicating with the other countries. So, I'm pretty sure that my dad as well was one of the people who had learned to use English during the studies and then used it at work as well.
Okay, so your family didn't speak it at home. You only spoke Finnish. And then just in most of your life, you spend most of your time speaking Finnish. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And is that the same case right now? So you mostly use your English when you're interacting with clients or with people like me outside other countries?
Yep.
Very cool. I wish that I could have done this podcast with you in Finnish, but unfortunately my only second language is Spanish, which is fine, but I mean, Finnish would be fantastic too. What's your, actually, just so we can get a taste of it, why don't you just give yourself a little introduction in Finnish? Just like say, hey, my name's Aasi and like I like to do Elm or whatever, just so we can hear it.
Hei, mun nimi on Ossi. Mä tykkään koodata Elmiä.
Very cool. I think I understood it. You said, hey, my name's Aasi and I like to do Elm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I cheated a little bit. All right, so at what point, so you said that at some point you started to learn it by heart, the computer commands.
Yeah.
And on that same, like the DOS stuff. And then when did that turn into a thing that you were actually producing on? Or at what point did that start to become something where you were doing web technologies?
So fast forward a couple of computers.
Okay. Was it always PC?
There was a Pentium, 60 megahertz Pentium with an actual modem. And then
okay,
I think that was only for Telnet.
Okay.
And then some other, like my dad's computer. It was some kind of a like precursor to a laptop, essentially. But then after that, I got my first own PC, and that was a tiny desktop computer.
Okay, was that something you purchased yourself? How'd you get a hold of that?
I just asked my parents to get me one.
Very cool.
So
was that a new thing or like a used at a yard sale kind of situation?
I don't remember, actually. I think it might have been from my dad's work. Somehow.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Super cool. So that was that running Windows by that time?
Yeah, that was running Windows 95, probably.
Excellent. Best operating system, right?
Yeah. Or maybe 98. I don't know. But anyway, sometime later, I got the Microsoft Office package, and it included the Microsoft Front Page.
Okay.
Which was an interesting WYSIWYG kind of way to create web pages. So that worked really well, except it only worked for Internet Explorer. So that was the time when you could build websites and then slap on the badge where it says, this is optimized for Internet Explorer and the 800 by 600 resolution.
Yeah, absolutely. So
and then you
was
would just put like a starry galaxy background and yellow text on top and then some like spinning construction lights.
Oh, so good. And flashing text.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That was contemporary then with kind of the Netscape era, Netscape Internet Explorer battle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back when being compatible with Internet Explorer was like the thing you wanted to do because they were killing it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got paused for a while. So really, FrontPage only generated pages that could work with Internet Explorer then.
Yeah, essentially. It was very complicated in terms of code that it produced, and it even had some like tags or attributes that would only work with Microsoft technologies. So that was the time when you had home pages.
What kind of stuff were you putting up on that page?
I have no idea. Probably some like, these are my favorite gifts from the internet.
Yeah. Excellent. MySpace before there was MySpace.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
And at that point, how old do you think you were when you were doing that?
I would say probably something like 10.
Okay, nice.
So that was elementary school, definitely.
At some point after that, did you start to get into the code side of things to do your own stuff?
So that was around the time when in Finland we have like a two-stage elementary school. So when I was going to the upper level, that was the time when I decided that FrontPage is not good enough anymore. I need to see what it's doing like below the surface. And so I bought this Basics of HTML book in Finnish.
Excellent.
That someone had written a couple of years prior. And I just basically read through all of it and tried to mimic all the exercises on my own. That's how I got started, really, in building websites through code.
Excellent. And so that was during the second half of elementary school. So did you just continue doing personal pages and then at some point ended up getting a gig, like getting paid to do something with that? How did that develop?
So,
or did you just go to school after that for computer stuff?
Yeah, I was part of this tiny clique called Custom Domains, like personal domains.
Okay. Like, is that like an online clique?
Yeah, so this was the time when people didn't have the opportunity to put up a MySpace page or anything like that. You had to build the website on your own. And if you were like deep enough in that hobby, then you would purchase a domain name for yourself. And then, like, participate in these, they were called cliques.
Interesting. And was that driven by a chat room area that you could go?
No, I don't actually remember how we, like, found each other.
Okay.
I guess there was, there was a single, like, personal domain person who had like a listing of all the Finnish personal domain holders.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then you would find all the other websites that people have created through that site. And then you could maybe go through what they've been doing. That was the one of the normal things you would do is put up a small blog-like thing.
So this is kind of like the old web ring concept where you join someone's web
ring. This is exactly the thing, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, in Finland we called them cliques.
Okay, cool. So you were part of that and that had your homepage on it.
Yeah.
And did you do that for other people too, or was that just kind of a... that carried you on for a little while to your next thing?
I think at that point I was like getting pretty familiar with the way that the web works in general, how you can put things up there, and that stayed as a hobby for quite a while for me. And during high school, I was thinking IT would always stay a hobby for me, and my real passion would be somewhere else, like architecture maybe, or interior design, something like that.
Okay, interesting, yeah.
When I got my high school done, I applied for architecture, but then I didn't get accepted. It's a very strict, there's like 1% of applicants get in.
Wow. So, and where was this? University of?
That was the Helsinki University of Technology.
Very cool. Okay.
But then I got in on a reserved seat to this really strange program called Information Networks, which was essentially a precursor to the current Aalto University. So it was sort of like a cross-disciplinary program with things from computer sciences and processing management, and then some automation as well.
Huh.
The first fall was mostly filled with Java.
Okay.
So that was when I actually started to love programming and not just creating things that you can see on the web.
What kind of programs did they have you writing at that point?
So that's what actually got me interested. The way that they taught that at Information Networks was very different. They had produced some exercise like templates for building your own text adventure. And it had like dragons and basilisks and all sorts of enemies that you can encounter, and some interesting chests and stuff like that. So it was really, really well put together as a whole, and you really got like knee deep the second you get on the course.
Sounds like lots of fun too. Not just boring exercises.
Yeah. So then I decided that I would learn more of these programming things because it seems like fun. Unfortunately, the rest of the courses were not that great.
Okay.
Because they were like normal CS courses from then on.
Yeah.
But I still liked all the things that we were doing. Not necessarily the way that they were taught. But anyway, I did enjoy programming, and that seemed like something I could do for work as well. And then a couple of years later, I got this part-time job at a marketing agency making WordPress sites and Facebook apps. And that was how I got on my career.
That was while you were still in school? So you were working and doing that at the same time? Were you doing full-time? So burning the candle
part-time
at both ends? Part-time. Okay. So did you finish up school while you were working at that consultancy still?
Actually, I've never finished school.
Okay.
I'm still working on it.
As many of us end up doing.
Right, because the work life is so much more interesting than what the CS courses had to offer.
So are you still planning to finish school, or is it kind of going to just peter out? What do you think?
I think I'm going to finish, yeah, because there's so little left.
So did you have, you had some big project you had to do on your own at the end, and you've already done most of that?
Yeah, that's mostly done. It needs some adjustments.
Interesting. What kind of project is that?
It's a case study for newspaper-related user interface development.
Okay.
It's a tool that lets people, like editors, set the layout for news articles that would appear in responsive websites.
Oh, that sounds pretty interesting. And this is for a bachelor's degree or the equivalent of a bachelor's degree, I'm assuming?
No, it's a master's. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. So this is your master's thesis.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Do you have to write anything? Any prose?
Yeah, it's like a 50-page thesis. Yeah.
Oof. Have you written that yet?
Yep.
Wow, way to go. So how did you find the time to do all of this? I mean, you started working at the consultancy part-time. You've done all this stuff on the side, including your 50-page thesis. How did you fit that stuff in together? And also, how long did you work at the consultancy, and did you move on from there to new opportunities after?
Yeah, so the marketing agency I worked for a year and a half, and after that, I moved on to another, like, bigger marketing agency, and probably worked around the same amount of time.
So that was two agencies, and that was both during school. Yeah. Neither of those are Futurist, is that right?
No.
Or Futurize. How do you say it?
So that's a good question. There's like a poster on our office saying all the different kinds of pronunciations people have had.
That's funny. Is there like a canonical, the creator said, had this idea in his or her head when they created it?
No.
Okay. How do you like to say it?
I like to say Futurist because the Londoners say that.
Okay.
But one of the funny things that I'll sometimes say is Futurice.
I like that.
Yeah.
How would it sound in Finnish?
So the way that people in Finland usually say it is just Futu.
Really?
Without the latter part.
Why is that?
Well, I guess it's hard to say the latter part.
Okay, so then it's not a Finnish word.
No, not at all.
Do you know anything about the founding? Like, where did the word come from? Did it come from London or what?
No, it was actually founded by a couple of people from the Helsinki University of Technology. I think it was like 11 years ago.
Okay.
And back then, there was a term ICE, which was something like Information and Communications Engineering.
Okay, yeah.
And then they just put like Future and ICE together.
Interesting. So and it's then, Future ICE, but it's Futurist or Futurize.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Futurice, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Exactly.
That's pretty funny. Okay, so I digress, but at what point do you get to Futurist then in your work history?
So then after the other marketing agency, I worked for 2 months for a small startup that my friend had been founding.
Okay.
And then during that time, I applied to Futurist for a summer job and got accepted. So that's how I got in.
That's cool. So how long have you been there now?
About 4 years and something more.
Wow. Okay. So then when did you start school? Have you been doing school for a long time?
Yeah, I started school, like university, I started in 2006.
So that's been a nice little journey, 11 years of school for you.
Yeah. Well, the most work I did was during that 4 years when I was actually like attending.
Yeah.
And then the rest is basically I've been working full time.
So tell me then, how have you fit that in, and do you have outside engagements? Do you live alone or do you have family? Like how do you make your schedule work out?
I live with my wife. We've been together for 10 years now.
Awesome.
We've been married for a couple of years. It was during high school that I met her.
Both students at the same high school?
Yeah.
Cool.
And then we just stuck together.
And what does she like to do? What is her interest, area of interest?
She's a vet.
So she doesn't get to tell you like what you're doing wrong with your programming?
Well, she does, because she has gone through a lot of the online courses.
Very cool. That's awesome. So then for your school stuff, you've been just working on it in the evening hours or just outside of work? What does that look like?
So at Futurist, we have this thesis camp thing as well. So you can have about a month or two of somewhat paid holiday to do some schoolwork.
Oh, that's cool. And is that just one-time thing, or is that like a per year, or what? What is that?
That's a one-time thing, but okay. We have flexible work hours as well. I was on an hourly contract for a long time, so yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, do you love it a futurist? Are you thinking that you're kind of good how things are going right now? Like, how are you feeling in your life with your current setup?
I'm pretty happy. I was thinking earlier that I wouldn't be able to, like, work at the same place for more than 3 years or so.
Yeah.
But because essentially we have 6 to 9 months projects and you work with a team. So after the 6 or 9 months, you sort of change the entire team, and like it's sort of like you've switched jobs at that point.
Interesting.
Even though we still have like the support of a very like very large and well educated group of people.
Yeah, you don't have to like do all the painful parts of changing jobs.
Yeah, and we have like developers, designers, UX designers, service designers, and business advisory. So in the best projects, we get to affect essentially the whole journey from a pain point in the business of the customer to an actual working product. So that's
awesome.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds very satisfying. So what have been your favorite top two projects you've worked on, you think, so far there?
Well, I think I have to pick the two Elm projects.
Okay.
They were great projects, both of them.
Are you allowed to say what they were, or is that kind of under wraps?
Well, I can't say the names, but
okay.
The topics were mentioned at my ElmConf talk last year.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. The ElmConf talk, I was going to mention it and forgot. So tell us a little bit about that. You came to ElmConf US last year and spoke, and you spoke on the topic of, it was kind of on scaling and app organization. It was kind of on triplets instead of components. Is that right?
Yeah.
You had fun hand-drawn slides too.
Yeah. I think that's what people most remember about the talk. I was part of two actual customer projects that were using Elm at that point and felt like not that many people have done this before. So my talk was essentially like tidbits of information that I had learned during the almost 2 years that I had used Elm at that point.
So I forgot to ask this, but how did you start using Elm? How did you encounter it and start using Elm? And why was that interesting to you?
So functional programming was a bit of a buzzword at Futurists like 3 years ago.
Okay. With the React inception or before that?
I think it was around the time that React like came to be.
Okay. And I imagine if people were using Scala Play on the back end that you heard it because of that too?
Yeah,
or is that a
too.
Recent thing? Okay.
And also because of Andre, who okay. was formulating his own reactive but still functional paradigm.
Yeah.
So I was in between projects and decided that I'm going to learn this functional programming thing now. And for some reason, I just had happened upon Elm before that.
Just with a Google search or a link or something?
I don't know. It just popped into my mind that there is this language that is supposedly a simple language. Like, there's not that many things to it. And knowing myself, I decided that I cannot learn functional programming by doing it in JavaScript, because then when I encounter some troubles, I will just like bail out and try to make do in the parts that I understand functional programming already, you know?
I think that's wise. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Plus, so, I've also found functional programming in JavaScript to be way harder than like anything else, just because you don't have a type system to help you.
Yeah, that's so, true.
Well, yeah, anyway. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interject. Go ahead.
So anyway, I just decided that, what the hell, I'm going to try this new language. Might go well, might not, but I have some spare time, so I'm going to use it to learn. And something that was essentially meant for me learning to use some of the functional concepts turned into a proposition that, what if we actually made or tried to use Elm in this customer project? Because I was so impressed by the compiler and the type system that I had really no reason not to propose something that I had only learned for a month at the time.
Yeah.
And, well, we did have like a escape plan so that we would try out the hardest things that we can foresee in the project.
Yeah.
We would try making those in Elm. And if that seems to work out, then like we're good to go.
Interesting.
But if that doesn't work, then we can use ClojureScript, or if that doesn't work out, then we can use React.
Yeah, a fallback table. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah. But then,
so then was this version 0.15?
Yeah, that was probably 0.15. I don't remember.
So it was a couple years ago.
Yeah, I think I started with 0.14, but I think it didn't have that much like difference with 0.15.
Yeah, I think they were pretty similar. How did your teammates react to the old concepts of mailboxes, etc.? I mean, were they familiar with the FRP paradigm? I assume that Andre was. I don't know that he was on your team, but I mean, that's kind of a general FRP pattern. He was?
He wasn't.
Oh, okay.
So we started the project with a person who had been doing Clojure before.
Okay.
So he was familiar with at least functional programming in general, but I think also some of the FRP concepts, like from Reagent. So,
for those who are listening and who didn't listen to the history episodes, FRP stands for Functional Reactive Programming, and Elm used to have a different structure than it does now for doing events and things like that. There's that. So, sorry, go ahead, Aussie.
Yeah, Signals was definitely one of the like major obstacles in the journey to learn Elm. But I think the colleague grasped it pretty quickly. Maybe I was able to explain it at the time, or maybe he was just a great programmer in general.
Well, and you had only had a month of this at this point, you said.
Yeah.
And you grasped it well enough in a month to actually do stuff with it. And this was your first experience with functional programming.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Did you do, what kind of resources were you using to learn? Was there a book? I mean, there wasn't a whole lot around at that point, I know, because I was there just after that. But what kind of stuff did you use to teach yourself?
I think essentially I was looking at the documents, like the documentation for packages. That was
okay, just the API
major source for my information. But since I had like a whole month to build something, I started building a sort of like a Space Invader sort of game.
Yeah.
And, well, I came up with a way to transform the signal of time into something that is moving on the screen. And then the bullets were a whole different problem because you would have to keep track of which are going to collide with something and stuff like that.
Oof.
So
the geometry.
Yeah.
Trigonometry.
Yeah. So I got into a lot of the like most difficult mathematical problems that you encounter within the first month. So from then on, it was not that hard anymore.
So the hard part was the math, not so much the programming part.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I never had any troubles with the types. I don't really remember a time when I was like really struggling with the types at all. I remember times when I was struggling with how does the Pythagorean theorem work and stuff like that.
Right.
But yeah, signals and tasks, those were the big things to learn at the time.
Right.
And mailboxes, essentially signals, both tasks. Of those have been put on the side nowadays.
Yeah, well, signals are complete. They're not even available anymore. I think I've seen a signal library that someone has written on top of the current abstractions, but and tasks are still used, but it's all about commands and messages now, which is, I think it's been a nice development. It simplified things quite a bit.
Yeah.
Even though it has removed some power. I mean, I did discover right after the removal that there were some things I was reaching for, some things I was doing with signals that I could no longer do. But, you know, in practice, I haven't really needed to do those in actual application development either. It was more like I think I was making a game thing and I wanted to do something very specific with signals. And I was like, I can't do this anymore. What kind of junk is this? I didn't get mad, but I was like, oh, you can't make the language less powerful. But you know, a lot of those concerns just kind of melt away after you don't actually need to do those things. It turns out some people, at least. I digress. Well, that is really cool. I like that. I like that inception story or beginning story. Inception is not the right word there, but let me ask you if you have any pointers for Elm developers, because you've been around for a while helping people in Slack and in the community. And so I want to know kind of what is one of the most common questions and problems, misunderstandings you see, and how do you, what do you recommend for people to clear that up? And then after that, let's do our picks.
That's a good question. Debugging is something that comes up quite a lot.
You mean people expecting to be able to debug like with the browser debugger?
Yes. And then they are very confused when you try to explain that. You don't actually need to do that when you're developing with Elm.
Yeah. So what do you tell them instead? What's the kind of solution and approach that you present for them?
Mostly I tell them about the experience. I usually even show them that in my text editor, Adam, I can just go and type stuff and the editor will tell me where the errors are. And once that check goes through, then essentially the code will work. It might not do what I want it to do, but it does work. So there's not that much debugging in the sense of what the hell is going on.
Yeah. I've actually found the most confusing points for me where I have found the Elm debugger helpful are inspecting the state to see if I've done the right thing to the state. Because there's, like you said, that's a logic error, right? Maybe I just updated it wrong. Like, did I send the right messages? So to see if messages are coming through properly. And often my problem with messages have been like a failing decoder, or I'm failing encoder. Yeah, decoder, event decoder, things like that. Those have been the tricky spots for me that the Elm debugger has helped with that the browser debugger wouldn't really help with very much.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? Have you had any tricky debugging situations that you would mention here and kind of tricks for getting around those?
Actually, not in the real projects.
Interesting. Okay.
But I was making this sort of like a two-person snake game.
Okay.
And again, we come to the math and the collision detection stuff.
Yeah.
So that was where the debugger was super, super helpful, because I could export some of the buggy examples and then try to fix it, import that, and then see if it actually helped or not.
So you would just replay the state.
Yeah.
And so I assume you weren't using ports or anything that would require you to, you could replay the whole state from within.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The game. That's awesome. You hear it there, folks. Elm debugger is very cool, but not as a debugger like you would think in the browser. All right, Aussie, you got any picks?
Yes, I have.
Let's hear them.
So the first one is actually technical. It's related to learning. So I want to recommend watching Evan Chaplicki's Conf Talks, all of them. They are brilliant. He's like a genius, and he can somehow like immerse you in his incredible brain while he's giving the talks. And the second one is also related to learning, and the second pick is learning by teaching. So I think this is the most powerful way for me to learn something, trying to explain how things work. That is the way how you can find the like tiny little black boxes in your understanding of something.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
The previous episode of Elmtown, which is at this moment unpublished, I spoke with my coworker who I helped learn Elm. And boy, that experience, when I tried to explain things to him that I thought I understood, I found myself saying, like, actually, is it that? Actually, I don't know. Actually, let me get back to you on that, on so many topics. Because, like you said, trying to explain it and teach it really uncovered holes in my understanding.
Yeah.
So what kind, how do people get the opportunity to teach?
I guess you just need to be proactive with it. So anything that you feel like you have some sort of grasp on, try to incorporate you, yourself, somehow into a situation where another person is trying to do the same thing. And I've had this incredible experience myself this summer. I've
Okay.
been working with a new employee. He hasn't done like software development in a company before. And he had that opportunity to work on this open source Elm project
Okay.
called Tradenomiitti. So we've been working on a fork of that, which is for an organization called Mothers in Business. So it's like a social, well, you can post up some things like, I'm up for mentoring someone, stuff like that. And
Oh, that's way
so
cool.
it's nice to have one for a lot of different kinds of nonprofit organizations. So that's what we've been doing. And it's been incredibly nice for me to try and explain all the different difficult concepts in Elm and in that particular application that have not been developing myself. Try to understand how it works and then teach that.
Wow, that sounds like a great exercise. Get
Yeah.
someone, work with them on it, learn it yourself and teach it. Super cool. So, would you recommend doing that over something like meetup hackathons or talking at conferences or making instructional videos or all of those things? Kind of what's your favorite flavor there?
Well, my personal favorite is like working face to face with someone. But that's obviously not always possible. And some people actually prefer working on their own. But I've seen Luke Westby make his Twitch recordings.
Yeah.
And that seems like it fits him really well. And I suppose it just depends on what kind of a person are you. What works for you. So you just need to learn how you want to teach.
So I guess just try them out if you've never tried them before. Try out different things. I agree. I also do. I do some conference talks and I do videos on egghead.io, and that's been a great opportunity for me to realize what I don't know. Because as I go to explain it, it's just, man, I need details. I need to fill in those empty spots in my mind. So I think that's a great pick, Aussie. I love that. Did you have another one?
Yeah, one more. This
Great.
is totally unrelated to our work.
Okay.
So, foraging or picking mushrooms. It's the greatest time of the year to do some mushroom picking. Go do it.
That's awesome. But that can be dangerous, right? Like, what if you pick bad mushrooms? You need to take a pig with you?
Yeah, so you need to know which kind of mushrooms you can pick, but it's not that complicated. You can start with a single species and then just stick to that one.
Have fun. That's awesome. Do you just go out into, I mean, where in Helsinki can you go pick mushrooms?
There's plenty of forests nearby. So
wow,
you can just basically go anywhere.
That's awesome. And then do you cook with them afterward?
Yeah, sure.
Great. I love it. I have never been foraging. I'd like to do that. That's very cool. All right, Aussie. Well, so I don't have any picks today. I am a lazy non-picker today, and that's okay. I'm just consoling myself. That's okay.
It is okay.
Thanks, Aussie. So where can people reach you for contact? And is that okay if people contact you?
Yep, it is okay. Probably the Elm Slack is the best currently.
And what's your handle on Elm Slack?
Oh, Hanhi.
Okay. And so, that's @OHANHI. Yep. I'll put it in the show notes.
Exactly.
Great. What about Twitter?
I'm also on Twitter and probably will answer you if you try, but I'm not that active there anymore.
Okay. Yeah, same thing here. So Elm Slack, Twitter, both available.
Yes.
And I am as well. Everyone hears this all the time, but I'm Sploding Socks everywhere, so feel free to look me up there. Big thank you, Aussie, for taking your time and donating it to us in the show, but also just in the help that you provide in the community and in the work that you do. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Murphy, for doing this.
You're welcome. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.